from outside now, though, as an American?
I mean, I think it really remains to be seen, but there are definitely fundamental changes taking place. If you look, for example, at recent polling, what you find is that the CIA is now one of the most admired and defended institutions among Democrats, while Republicans don't like the CIA and actually prefer Vladimir Putin even to Barack Obama. You have radical shifts taking place in coalitions, in alliances, in alignments, and it's very unpredictable how it can play out. Sometimes instability can produce positive outcomes. Trump abrogated the TPP. He wants to limit Boeing and Lockheed and the amount of money that's spent on them. He wants to bring jobs back to the U.S., but it can also have very dangerous outcomes as well because of its unpredictability. And so I think it's a very dangerous time for the United States, and it's one of the reasons why I'm hoping Democrats find their footing and become a lot more focused and reasoned and stop sort of wallowing in these radical conspiracy theories that make them appear unhinged, because Donald Trump needs a cohesive and focused and effective opposition.
We're going to leave it there. Glenn Greenwald, thanks so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, one of the founding editors of The Intercept. We'll link to your pieces. Most recently, Wash Post is richly rewarded for false news about Russia threat while public is deceived. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Gottesdiener, Esther Samalkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride. On his birthday, Sunday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the first annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on January 8th at 3 p.m. at the Bowie Bike Lane at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right hand side of the homepage under community events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon volunteers have refurbished two school buses in order to use them as medical facilities at Standing Rock. One of the buses is already in North Dakota, and the second one rolls out of Portland next week. We will speak with the organizers.
Sub-freezing weather has prompted the city of Portland to open up one of its office buildings as a warming shelter, probably through Saturday night.
And Democrats, as well as Republicans, battle over repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 5th, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Particularly cold weather from the Arctic zone has chilled the air in and around Portland, placing the houseless community in peril. On Monday evening, a 51-year-old man, Mark Elliott Johnson, was found dead from exposure inside an alcove on an East Burnside storefront. And yesterday, 11 individuals camped outside near 92nd and Holgate in East Portland, and they were swept without warning by Oregon Department of Transportation officials who confiscated all of their belongings, which they could not carry with them. The collective of individuals were only offered information regarding the nearest warming shelter, which was a two-mile walk in the cold to Clackamas Service Center. ODOT officials explained that the homeless individuals were engaged in, quote, extremely illegal unquote, behavior, and were in danger of being injured by de-icing and road-clearing vehicles. This flies in the face of Multnomah County and the City of Portland's assurance that, during this cold weather, no houseless campers will be required to move. The City of Portland and Multnomah County's response to the cold front was accommodating, with Portland and City Hall opening its doors as an overnight warming shelter. Mayor Ted Wheeler announced yesterday that the Portland building downtown is temporarily opening its doors to fit 90 people who are in need of shelter and of supplies.
Portland Mayor, Mayor Ted Wheeler, said today the Portland building in downtown Portland will stay open as a warming shelter tonight and Friday, and most likely Saturday. It is the first time a mayor of the city has opened up a major municipal office building for houseless people to shelter against the cold. By contrast, former Mayor Charlie Hale's first act on housing when he gained office in January of 2013 was to sweep houseless people camping on the sidewalks around City Hall. This week's sub-freezing temperatures have prompted a scramble among housing advocates who have fanned out across the city to help vulnerable people. An estimated 4,000 Portlanders are now living in the streets. City officials say the Portland building will open around 7 p.m. on these nights. Transition projects will be staffing the Portland building during its shelter hours. For more information on housing services and warming shelters, dial 211.
The Port of Portland is suing the Monsanto Corporation for polluting the Willamette River with PCBs and then conspiring to hide this fact. According to the lawsuit, Monsanto polluted its industrial sites, but it knew since at least 1937 that PCBs cause cancer and other health problems. Monsanto held the exclusive patent to produce polychlorinated biphenyl until it was banned by the federal government in 1979. Monsanto is linked to 9 Superfund sites all around the country. Other municipalities around the nation have started suing Monsanto on the same grounds, including the state of Washington. The giant agrochemical corporation had estimated net sales last year of more than $15 billion.
Crabbers along the West Coast are not getting out to sea as the season starts because of a price dispute. The strike affects other professions associated with the crabbing industry as well.
Dungeness crab dinners could be hard to come by in Oregon and along the West Coast because of a dispute over the price that crabbers get for their catch. Fleets from Central California to the Canadian border are refusing to fish as the crabbing season opens along the coast. The strike is due to a price drop before Christmas when Pacific Seafood began offering $2.75 per pound instead of $3. John Corbin, an Oregon fisherman and chairman of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission, says crabbing is expensive, especially for the substantial amount of bait used.
They're getting us on both ends here. They're charging us more for bait, and they're wanting to pay less for the crab. So it's just cutting into the bottom line, and we just can't do that.
Corbin says Oregon state officials have been mediating negotiations with a seafood company. Pacific Seafood says it is just one of many buyers on the West Coast and doesn't set the price alone. Corbin says commercial crabbers would much rather be fishing, but the price drop could set a precedent they can't afford, especially with recent increases in fuel prices. He says the strike affects a lot of families.
We've got about 1,200 boats. That's 4,000 to 5,000 fishing families that are unemployed right now. The processors don't have crab for their workers to process, so there's processing families that are unemployed. There's a lot of people affected by this.
On Wednesday, crabbing opened on Washington State's coast, but no crabbing vessels set out. The Quinault Indian Nation has also joined commercial crabbers in the strike. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
The Millennium Bulk Terminal Company has hit another snag in its effort to build a coal shipping facility on state-owned aquatic land near Longview, Washington. A request by Northwest Alloys to sublease the land to Millennium was rejected on Tuesday by the state's outgoing public lands commissioner, Bill Goldmark. His incoming successor, Hillary Franz, has not explicitly said that she will follow his lead, but has expressed opposition to fossil fuel terminals being built on public land in the past. Millennium's project would ship up to 44 metric tons of coal per year to Asian markets. That might be more than 44 metric tons. It might be 44 million metric tons. We'll be back on that one. They have been opposed every step of the way. Environmental groups, some of whom have hailed Goldmark's decision as the end of the line for Millennium. Millennium disagrees, citing a letter from the state dating to 2013 that refers to Millennium as the operator of the facility. But without an actual sublease, it's unclear how Millennium plans to proceed legally with the project. The environmental law group Earthrise has pledged to sue if Millennium moves forward, saying it is well within the state's right to deny the sublease. In the meantime, Millennium's parent company has begun shipping coal through a terminal in British Columbia.
The U.S. Senate defeated a bid by Democrats to ensure that the bare bones of the Affordable Care Act would be preserved in moves to roll back the law. The GOP priority is already gaining steam, weeks before the new administration even takes control. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Senators from both sides of the aisle argued for changes to the Affordable Care Act Thursday. The debate is part of the budget reconciliation process, to which the GOP has tied its moves to unpack the law, also known as Obamacare. Republicans like Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi decry what they call a law that resulted in higher costs and lower levels of coverage. They want to repeal and replace the health care law that blocks insurers from refusing to cover individuals with pre-existing medical issues, allows parents to cover their children until they are 26, and requires most taxpayers to purchase an insurance policy.
While Republicans will start by repealing Obamacare immediately, we will ensure a stable transition in which those with insurance will not lose access to health care coverage. This will allow us to move step by step to a new set of reforms, listening carefully to the advice of millions of Americans affected and making sure that we proceed wisely, doing no harm.
But no replacement proposal is ready. Republicans say there will be a delay before a repeal takes effect, an interim period during which a new health care law can be crafted. Democrats say, while not perfect, the ACA needs to be updated, but not tossed out. According to a report by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, repealing Obamacare could cost almost 25 million people their access to health coverage, more than half of them Medicaid recipients. To protect them, Senate Democrats introduced an amendment that sought to set a baseline for all budget reconciliation proposals. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy was among the sponsors.
We are repealing the Affordable Care Act with no plan for what comes next. We are driving forward with a repeal vote with no plan for how we keep the healthcare system together, how we prevent it from falling into chaos, how we continue to ensure the millions of Americans that rely on it. There is a cruelty to this enthusiasm for immediate repeal that is a little bit hard to understand. It's really hard to understand.
The amendment would have prohibited bills as part of budget reconciliation that lower the number of people covered under the law, boost premiums, or cut benefits. It failed along party lines, 48-52. Changing the law is not a simple matter. The convoluted process that Senator Enzi kicked off this week would nitpick the measure through budget reconciliation, which allows for individual elements of the health care law to be overturned if they are budget positive. Reconciliation can drag on for months, include an unlimited number of amendments without debate, is not subject to filibuster, and only requires a simple majority to pass, making it inherently partisan and difficult to follow. More Senate action on health care is expected to continue next week, when lawmakers will also consider high-level cabinet nominations by President-elect Donald Trump, his pick for Attorney General, ACA opponent, and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, and longtime ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State. Nell Abram, FSRN.
Slight correction, it was 44 million metric tons planning to be shipped out of Longview, Washington per year. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan from Wisconsin continues to hold an open poll concerning the dismantling of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. Constituents and the public can call in with opinions about Obamacare through a phone survey, the directions for which have been circulating widely on social media since November of 2016. Callers are told to expect dead air before pressing 2 for the survey. Once there, callers can select 1 to express support or 2 to express opposition to Obamacare, with options to leave voicemail. As of this report, the voicemail was full. Critics to the poll say the format lacks bipartisan formatting. They say that in order to reach the survey, callers must listen to a long message giving Paul Ryan's serious concerns about the implementation of Obamacare. The message continues to elaborate the bill, saying it intends to, quote, eliminate the most harmful pieces of the Affordable Care Act, unquote. Ryan has been an avid opponent of Obamacare, saying that it has limited choices for patients and a coverage gap for low-income people. According to the Gallup poll, 58% of Americans have supported the idea of a federally funded health care system, with the remainder of them favoring keeping Obamacare in place without repeal.
A county sheriff in Maryland has offered Donald Trump inmates from his jail to help build the wall around Mexico. Sheriff Thomas Hodgson from Bristol County, Maryland, says he is inspired by a program called Project NICE, or National Inmates Community Endeavors, a federal work program using prison labor. Last year, a number of municipalities around the United States sent deputies to Standing Rock, where they helped blast water protectors with water cannons, plastic bullets, and beanbag rounds. Hodgson says he's pitched the idea to the Trump transition team. According to the legal blog Crime Report, Hodgson has been told by other sheriffs across the U.S. they are ready to join in.
The Senate Armed Services Committee met today with top intelligence officials to discuss allegations of Russian interference in the 2016 American election cycle. Robert Packard with FSRN has more on this.
National Intelligence Director James Clapper, his Undersecretary Marcel Letra, and Director of the NSA's U.S. Cyber Command, Admiral Michael Rogers, appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee Thursday to publicly address increasingly louder accusations that Russia interfered in last year's U.S. elections to favor Republican candidates, notably President-elect Donald Trump. Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island called for both concrete evidence and bipartisanship on the matter.
Despite the indifference of some to this matter, our nation needs to know in detail what the intelligence community has concluded was an assault by senior officials of a foreign government on our electoral process. Our electoral process is the bedrock of our system of government. An effort to manipulate it, especially by a regime with values and interests so antithetical to our own, is a challenge to the nation's security, which must be met with bipartisan and universal condemnation, consequences, and correction.
Many Democrats have focused on the allegations of hacking, particularly the DNC email leaks. Senator Tim Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate, asked about Russia's role in spreading viral disinformation about Democratic candidates in the final weeks of the election.
You know, I had a little role in this election. I was along for the ride for 105 days and was the subject of a couple of fake news stories. And it was interesting, there were at least three that the mainstream media didn't cover because they were so incredible that, like, why would they? But I looked at one of the stories and it had been shared 800,000 times.
Euphemistically known as fake news, false stories gained serious traction on social media platforms and conservative blogs, and were even disseminated by at least one potentially key figure in Trump's upcoming administration, retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn.
And when I see an administration who is put in place as the proposed National Security Advisor, someone who traffics in these fake news stories and retweets them and shares them, who betrays a sense of either gullibility or malice that would kind of be, these are stories that most fourth graders would find incredible. That a national security advisor would find them believable enough to share them causes me great concern.
The intelligence officials present at Thursday's hearing offered general information on Russia's alleged interference, but said additional concrete details would come in a more comprehensive report they plan to release next week. For FSRN, I'm Robert Packard.
Descendants of the Namibian tribesmen who were victims of the first genocide of the 20th century have sued Germany for reparations. While Germans wrestle with the implications of yet another dark episode in their history, KBOO's Sam Bowman has more.
In 1904, in modern-day Namibia, which at the time was called German Southwest Africa, the Herero and Nama peoples rose up against German colonial rule. In around 20 years of colonization, German settlers and soldiers had been using the native people as slave labor and were known for widespread use of rape and corporal punishment, and stole cattle from Herero herds. Both rebellions were crushed militarily by late 1904, and the tribes were driven into the eastern desert by German Lieutenant General Lothar von Trotha. Von Trotha issued an ultimatum to the Herero, declaring them citizens no longer and vowing to kill any Herero found within the frontier of German Southwest Africa. By 1908, upwards of 100,000 Herero and 10,000 Nama men, women, and children had died from starvation, thirst, and violence at the hands of von Trotha's troops. In 1985, the United Nations classified these events as the first deliberate genocide of the 20th century. Since then, the German government has twice recognized the events and apologized, but hasn't used the word genocide until 2015. Germany has been involved since late last month in talks with the Namibian government, including the idea of compensation for the genocide, though Germany has explicitly ruled out direct reparations to descendants of the victims. Now, some of those descendants have sued Germany in a U.S. court, saying that even if Germany gives aid to the Namibian government, it is unlikely any of it will trickle down to the tribes. They are suing under the Alien Torts Statute of 1789, which legal experts say allows foreign citizens to seek justice in U.S. courts for human rights violations committed on foreign soil. Germany has so far not commented on the lawsuit. Germany has previously paid reparations to the victims of the Holocaust during World War II. Despite the genocide in Namibia being largely forgotten by most of the world for most of the 20th century, documentation has since proved that it was a major influence on later German actions in Eastern Europe. Some scholars, such as Jürgen Zimmerer at Hamburg University, quoted in the Guardian newspaper, theorized that Germans would rather view the Nazi period as an aberration than as part of a historical continuum of brutal colonial practices. Leaders in the Herero and Nama tribes have no such qualms. In the words of Herero chief Vekui Rukoro, an apology without reparations would be, quote, the most insensitive political statement ever to have been made by an aggressor nation to the victims of its genocide. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
Tonight, we're going to debut a very special weekly feature called It's This Week Back Then.
Portland State University's History Department presents This Week Back Then. During This Week in 1972, Oregon became the fourth state in the nation to decriminalize homosexuality after revised sodomy laws went into effect on January 1st. I'm Evan Smiley. Let's rewind. First, I'd like to note that sodomy laws, or more accurately, anti-sodomy laws, still exist in Oregon and all over the United States. Oregon continues to legally define unacceptable or unusual sexual behavior. Though presently in the state of Oregon, only acts involving children or other non-consenting individuals are prosecuted in the court of law, the history and implications of the state's ability to define normal and abnormal sexual behavior and its ability to not only police but convict and even punish citizens who deviate from that definition is intriguing at best and horrifying at worst. So the first instance we see of Oregon-made sodomy legislation is in the Statutes of Oregon from 1853. And that sodomy clause from 1853, though vague and short as it was, has more or less survived for over a century, undergoing much deserved debate and revision. Now let's skip to 1913. Because of the Vice-Click scandal of 1912, in which a few well-known and prestigious businessmen of Oregon were put on trial for homosexual acts, citizens pressured the Oregon legislature to revise its sodomy law. So the revisions made in 1913 specified that any sexual act outside of male-female vaginal intercourse was illegal in the state of Oregon. The revisions also tripled the maximum jail time from the 1853 statute. In that same year, there was growing support for sterilization.
And although the sterilization legislation proposed in 1913 didn't pass, a very similar, almost identical law passed in 1917. So, the sterilization law of 1917 applied to anyone who was, quote, feeble-minded, insane, epileptic, habitual criminals, moral degenerates, or sexual perverts. And the thought process behind this legislation was if any individual who belonged to one of those categories reproduced, their offspring would inherently be inferior and more likely to be a burden on society. So how did the state place citizens into vague and subjective categories like insane or sexually perverted? Well, moral degenerates and sexual perverts were defined as those who participated in sodomy. So here's where it really all comes together. After 1917, if you were convicted of sodomy, which at the time was legally defined as anything but heterosexual vaginal intercourse, you were subject to the punishment of forced sterilization, either castration or ovarectomy, and sentenced to a maximum of 15 years in prison, followed by parole. The reality is that these two laws regarding sodomy and sterilization actively and directly targeted gay individuals as a means of legal, systematic oppression and punishment. And these laws stayed in effect unchanged for about 40 years. It wasn't until the middle of the century that either of these laws incurred any revision. During the early 1960s, the growing success of the civil rights movements encouraged other victims of discrimination, such as women and LGBT individuals, to protest and pressure the government into revising oppressive legislation, such as the sodomy and sterilization law. However, this call for sexual revolution, freedom, and equality was not met without opposition. The only revisions made to the sodomy laws during this time regarded age and consent, not sexuality. And specifications to the sodomy law in 1961 actually resulted in further sexual oppression. However, despite setbacks, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the sexual liberation and gay rights movements gained more traction as a political force in the United States, including Oregon. In 1965, Oregon legislation eliminated the phrase moral degenerates and sexual perverts from its sterilization law, removing physical punishment from sodomy convictions. Finally, in 1971, Governor Tom McCall signed the revisions of Oregon sodomy law, removing same-sex sexual activity as a legal transgression. Homosexuality wouldn't be decriminalized in all 50 states until 2003 after the Supreme Court ruling of Lawrence v. Texas. So this week we celebrate the anniversary of decriminalized homosexuality in Oregon. And while the past injustices inflicted on the LGBT plus community by the Oregon government should never be forgotten, and though we still have a ways to go in terms of equality and social justice, Oregon continues to exceed so many states in sexual freedom and acceptance. From being the fourth state to decriminalize homosexuality in 1972, to being the first state to recognize non-binary gender in 2016, Oregon has upheld its reputation as a pioneer of civil rights equality.
For more on this topic and others, please visit pdx.edu/history.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland with Sequoia Wright. Tomorrow's weather, 33 degrees and cloudy. In Philomath, it's cloudy and 35 degrees. In White Salmon, tomorrow it's sunny with a high around 27 degrees. Today in history, in 1781, British Brigadier General and traitor to the American Revolution, Benedict Arnold burned Richmond, Virginia to the ground. Quote of the day is from actor and playwright Lin-Manuel Miranda, who said, "History is so subjective. The teller of it determines it." And for those of you who need it, the address of the warming station in the Portland building is at 1120 Southwest 5th Avenue. Once again, that's 1120 Southwest 5th Avenue.
Fewer headlines are coming out of Standing Rock since the federal government denied a construction permit for one section of the proposed oil pipeline there. But the struggle is far from over. Oregon volunteers have refurbished two school buses to use as medical facilities at Standing Rock. The first one's already operational, and they're in North Dakota, but the second one is going to roll out next week. And here with us in KBOO Studios to talk about this are Ted Dreyer and Harlan Schober. Thanks for coming in, you guys.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, so tell us about the project and what's actually in these buses.
Both buses are equipped with bunks and a heating system, and they're heavily insulated. The second bus has eight bunks and more open space. It's designed to be more of a clinic. The first bus, I understand, is being used as a dormitory for women healthcare workers at the camp at Ochedi Sakowin.
I see. So it's there are people there, and these buses will be a place for them to do what they need to do.
Yeah, and the conditions are so severe that getting out of the wind and getting warm is the critical thing. People living there spend days going from one cold place to another, never really getting to warm up. So at least for the healthcare workers and people who are sick, this is vital.
We have received messages of thanks from people recovering from illnesses who have thanked us for providing a space where they can actually stay warm and recover from their diseases. So it's a mixed use right now.
I see. And will you guys be going with the bus next week?
That's
yes. Yes.
You'll be going with it.
Yeah.
Outstanding. And so did you just think this up? What made this thing happen?
How? I'm Harlan, and in September with Mike Horner, Mike and I drove a rental van to Standing Rock with donated supplies. We had originally planned to each take a pickup truck and a small trailer, and we put out the word that we had room for donations, and the donations kept flowing. We had so much more than we could carry. We rented a commercial truck and made the drive out there. And it was beautiful weather, big breeze blowing. It was end of September. And we realized that breeze wasn't going to slow down, but it was going to get cold. And so we came back here thinking about shelter as the primary need. And we spent about 2 weeks thinking of one idea and another. Could we do a request, you know, like people say, donate your car or your boat, that kind of thing. We thought maybe we could get travel trailers that way. And we talked about making teepees and other kinds of tents. And the idea of getting a school bus, because they're so cheap, and outfitting it, that's what gelled. And that's what we ended up doing.
I think it's important to point out, this is Ted speaking now, that Mike and Harlan were in close communication with the medics at Standing Rock, and that all these ideas developed in response to what they heard was needed. And so it was always sort of a dialogue between the people at Standing Rock explaining what they needed and the people here in Portland trying to figure out how they could address those needs.
And the donations came in from a variety of sources?
Oh, my God. I've used the expression, I've never had this much wind under my wings. We put this idea out, and we've had more than 500 cash donors to support the two buses. We've had, on the first bus, we had as many as 30 people volunteering, coming to work. People donated space where we could do the work. When we were delivering the first bus, we stopped in Bozeman. Bozeman. And there was a rally going on in town. We were invited to do a bit of a show and tell with the bus. And people came up and handed us money and just wished us well. People have supported this in every way you can imagine.
Donated supplies and labor and materials.
Yes.
It's been, I think, one of the really most moving aspects of this of this project, that this idea, because of Mike and Harlan, who came up with the idea, are, you know, just two guys paying attention to what is needed and what was needed at Standing Rock. And they didn't have the funds or the materials to do this. It was just an idea. And but as soon as the idea got out, all this energy flowed in. And I think it's a really inspiring thing. And it's a kind of a dark period in history right now. And I know a lot of my friends are feeling really frustrated and really depressed. And I know that's very widespread. And I think it's really wonderful to hear about the power that a good idea can have, even in this dark era, and the way that a few people with a positive idea can draw energy and start an enormous project that now is really actually helping people on the ground in Standing Rock and is really helping to save the water and the lives and all the things that the people at Standing Rock stand for, starting with nothing more than good intentions and a really good creative idea. I think we really need to hear about that.
We live in a very compassionate place here in Portland. What kind of feedback are you guys getting from the site out there in North Dakota?
At the camp itself, we were well received. They were happy to see the bus when we got out there. And we're hearing that they are eager to get the second bus. We didn't run into any resistance. Like, we didn't have strife with North Dakotan people in other towns. We thought we might. But this is medical support. And it, no one argues with it.
Was there any official resistance from any?
Oh no,
agency. Nope. Everybody was welcoming to it.
In fact, we had been. I had been concerned about that. And with the first bus, I was focused on getting the bunks in there, getting the heating system in, the lights, and getting down the road. And Mike Horner, who's my partner in this, insisted that we get some artwork on the outside. And that turned out to be hugely important. I'd been prepared to drive a yellow school bus and kind of sneak into camp and just not have any trouble, thank you, and just get it there. And we had this astounding artwork all over it done by a number of indigenous folks in Portland. And there was no doubt where we were going or what we were about, and we didn't run into any resistance.
In fact, that art, that's one of the amazing things about this project too, because it combined so many different kinds of energy. You know, some people were able to give funds and some people came and could work on the engine and some people painted, and then the artist came and did this amazing artwork. And the way that worked was amazing. Before we even got out of Oregon, we were in the follow-up car and we saw a Jeep pull in right behind the bus, and we thought, oh, that's kind of strange. What is that Jeep doing? And we saw, we wondered if it, you know, somebody was following us or trying to harass us. And when the bus pulled over for a stop, the Jeep followed us, and everybody was a little nervous about this. But the young man jumped out and he said, "You guys are having way too much fun. This is a beautiful bus. I'm going to Standing Rock. Is that where you're going?" And it turned out, we were, of course, still a little suspicious, but in time, this young man, who happened to be a Marine veteran, was a tremendous boon and addition to our group. And it's the kind of almost magical appeal that this bus has that attracted, just right out on the road, another recruit, so to speak, who ended up adding a tremendous amount. He was able to help us with some repairs when we got to camp, and it was a wonderful thing. He was a tremendously supportive person.
This event at Standing Rock is of national importance. Are there other spontaneous grassroots helping entities there?
This seems to have the most notoriety. It's the biggest deal going. I think there's a camp along the Mississippi in Iowa where they're trying to hold space and prevent going under the Mississippi River with the same pipeline. There are encampments in Arizona and up in Canada.
In Florida, too, I think.
Yeah. So This is not the only one, but it's the one that has really caught people's imaginations. And it feels like the one that cannot be allowed to fail. There's been a kind of a slowdown in news coming out of North Dakota about this ever since the administration's Army Corps of Engineers decision to deny the permit, as though that were the end of it. And it's nowhere near the end of it. This fight has just begun, really. With the new administration coming in, I've been characterizing the Standing Rock encampment and the resistance there and the use of military force by local law enforcement as kind of the Spanish Civil War of our time.
Yes.
And I don't think it's being too dramatic. If with the new administration having promised that this will be resolved quickly, which is pretty ominous, we could be looking at the Kristallnacht of our time. If the camp is routed by force, it'll be that ugly. And I don't know for sure, but I don't think the indigenous folks are packing up and leaving.
I want to add to that that the Standing Rock, you know, it seems to me is also in a very important and, for me, unexpected sense, a spiritual center of the whole country right now. I mean, the whole election demonstrates to me that the country has fallen into a kind of an ethical vacuum, and the request of Republicans' first act trying to disarm the ethical watch committee in the House is a representative of that. But the energy coming out of Standing Rock is amazing. And I am not a religious person in any sense, but the prayer ceremonies at 6 o'clock in the morning were very moving to me. And the elders that spoke there made it very clear that, yes, they're opposing this particular pipeline, but they are not simply aiming at this pipeline. The pipeline for them is a symbol of a whole way of approaching economics, nature, society, human beings, and they want to change it all. It is a very profound approach to criticizing our society, and I think the simple phrase that water is life summarizes a very complex set of issues in a very clear and powerful and simple phrase, which is not superficial, but very profound. So no, they aren't going away, and we need to support them. And the fact that other camps are starting is, I think, a reflection of the power and the energy coming out of Standing Rock.
That's right. We have to take a stand somewhere. And our listeners want to help you. In what way can they be of any help or support to your work?
Well, we have a group on Facebook that they can check out. It's called Bunk Bus to Standing Rock, and they can donate funds there. But if they go to that site, they can send a message, or they can indicate I can get in touch with them, and we still have an awful lot of work left to do on the bus, so we can still use volunteers. There are also many other groups in Portland. One group that we are working together with is Pacific Northwest for Standing Rock, and it's organized by some local Native American people, and they're doing a lot of good work fundraising for Standing Rock. So that's another web page that people can check out.
All right, well, Ted and Harlan, thanks so much for coming in. That was Ted Dreyer and Harlan Schober from the Bunk Bus Project. You can find out more about their work at Bunk Bus to Standing Rock and PNW for Standing Rock. Thanks again, guys.
Good night. Hey, thank you.
time for our monthly check-in with a grassroots activist at BARC. Here to talk about what's coming up is Jason Thoming-Gale and Lo Goldberg. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
So please introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about why you've been volunteering with BARC to protect Mount Hood National Forest.
Hi, I'm Jason, and BARC gives me and anyone else who cares deeply about Mount Hood National Forest a chance to become personally engaged in the resistance to commercial interests which seek to profit off of public lands that really are vital forest ecosystems, habitat for wildlife, both terrestrial and aquatic, amazing wilderness that must be left alone and intact for the sake of our clean drinking water and sweet breathing air. So that's why I'm out there on the ground with my feet.
And I'm Lo. I've been volunteering with BARC for nearly 10 years. I serve on the board of directors at BARC and the Forest Watch Committee, which monitors all the projects proposed in around Mount Hood National Forest and prioritizes which projects BARC focuses most on.
And what kind of work and activities have you all done as volunteers to pursue these goals?
I personally have been mostly ground truthing, which is something that is kind of integral to BARC's process. It's getting boots on the ground, sending people out into the forest to these timber sale units and kind of checking up on the data and collecting data and taking pictures and comparing what's really out there to what the Forest Service and the BLM have supposedly recorded. And so I've been ground truthing myself for about 8 months with BARC. That's awesome.
Among the many things I've done, ground truthing is definitely my favorite. Getting out there with a measuring tape on the ground, measuring the trees, measuring the slope of the landscape, looking for roads that the Forest Service